Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 7:30 a.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time on Friday, April 7th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And I'm recording a little earlier because I am flying to Singapore today for the chart seminar. So I'll need to be heading to the airport in the not-too-distant future. This was an eventful week. We had the Fed beginning to talk about how they are going to shrink the size of their balance sheet, that it doubled in 2008, and then it doubled again between 2008 and 2014, and it has been reasonably steady around $4.5 trillion for the last 3 years. And they're asking these legitimate questions because the assets that they hold have got maturities and yields have already risen. They want to start raising rates, but if they start raising rates and have to refinance all of that debt, then it is going to represent a significant headwind for the US Treasury. It isn't just the US that is thinking about these things. The Bank of England's chart looked exactly the same until about 2014 when they stopped updating it. It's probably their balance sheet has probably expanded since then because of the purchases that were announced after the Brexit vote last year. We've had synchronized global monetary expansion for the last few years, and that has represented a massive socialization of private sector debt. It has represented this massive expansion in the balance sheets of these governments. So it's not a purely US phenomenon. It is also a global phenomenon, but the US is the country that is closest to beginning to tackle the issue. And we've already seen that they've raised rates a couple of times. Now, it does represent rather big questions, and it is a question that is probably going to have to be answered by next year, because when we look at the maturity on debt, after the crisis in 2008, a great deal of debt was issued with 10-year maturities. There was a great deal of debt issued in 2009, 10, and 11, and 12 as well. A lot of that debt, this is the high yield maturities. There's quite a bit of it matures in 2017 and 18, but there is a large quantity of it is going to mature in 19 and 20 and 21 and 22. And this has nothing to do with the Fed's balance sheet. This is high yield. So this is something else entirely. This means that all of these companies that have been borrowing at incredibly low yields and very tight spreads, they are going to have to refinance that debt in 2019 and 2020. And the chances are that they're going to be doing so at a higher rate. And there is there was a point that I remember Jeff Gundlach making at this presentation 2 years ago, and it was quite simple. He said that the high yield market hasn't been around all that long. It really only began in the late 1980s, and that generally speaking, they don't ever pay back the principal. They're always refinancing, or they get taken over, or they call it back early. So the question of what they're going to do when they refinance it in 2019-2020 is a big question. And when we look at the loans on leveraged loans, then there is also this bubble of maturities that is coming due in the period between 2019 and 2021. But the Fed's balance sheet, which is obviously the one that most matters most to the size of that previous chart that we looked at of their balance sheet, we can see very clearly that there is in excess of $350 billion needs to be refinanced in 2019. So when they know as well as we do that those big maturities are out there on the horizon, they have to start thinking about what they're going to do. And what the bond market has concluded is that they're not going to be able to raise rates. When we look at two-year yields, they are at about 1.2%. So the bond market is betting that the Fed will only be able to raise rates once between now and April of 2019. Personally, I think that would require the Fed to engage in really quite a concerted effort to shrink the size of their balance sheet, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, but it would require there is no denying that if they do begin to shrink the size of the balance sheet, that is indicative of tightening. So they have two different ways that they could tighten. They could raise short-term rates, or they could withdraw money from the system. If they withdraw money from the system, then the question that I think should be asked is, what will happen to the velocity of that money? The velocity of money, let me just pull up a line chart. The velocity of money has been trending lower in a rather dynamic fashion since 1997, and there's no real end in sight. And this is an interesting factoid, I guess, because we can go back to 1959 with this data, and the velocity of money has never been lower. Now, there are any number of potential reasons, but personally, I don't see that it is a coincidence that the real introduction of the internet, and which was hailed during the 1990s as disintermediation, has represented a massive decline, or has coincided with a massive decline in the velocity of money. This is, I think, a cause and effect rather than a coincidence. If we just simply walk down the street, we can see quite clearly that the kinds of businesses that one would have seen even 10 years ago no longer exist. And certainly what I see now are service-oriented businesses. The resellers have been completely just blown away by the phenomenon that is Amazon. And online retail continues to gain ground. So this represents a challenge for the Fed. If they're going to reduce the size of their balance sheet, and we think about what it is that the Fed is supposed to do, what is central banking 101 is to ensure there's enough liquidity in the market to promote growth. But if the velocity of money is trending lower, then there is a logical argument for having more money in the system to ensure that there is enough of it to circulate. And if they withdraw some of that money, then they're going to need economic growth. They're going to need that velocity to pick up. And so far, there isn't any real evidence of that. That would suggest that maybe the bond market that we're not going to have a very dynamic move in the bond market if the Fed demurs from raising interest rates and moderately withdraws some of the liquidity. That is at least what the bond market is betting on. And when we look at the total return on bonds, and I didn't type that particularly well, then what we have is we've had a big pullback. We've seen that the index has stabilized, and it is now testing the region of the trend mean. And it did this before in 2013 after the taper tantrum. And this has been an incredible bull market, and it has been going up in a very orderly fashion since 1983. These pullbacks that we've seen since 2013 are by far the largest they've been, and perhaps more importantly, it has begun to spend more time trading below the trend mean. But it has continued to go up, and what is really required to confirm that this is a medium-term top is is that we see the pullback below the 200, below the lows that we've seen. So that is something that we are we would really have to see, that this isn't something that is completely done and dusted just yet. There is certainly evidence that that we've had a bigger pullback, and that there is a logical argument to say that if the economy is doing better and we do have rising rates, that coming off of extraordinarily low levels isn't something that we can just ignore. But the charts don't lie, and until we see that this is a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend, and then it breaks down again, we will not have confirmation that the top is in fact complete. So that represents a that is indicative of this rangy environment that we've had, that there is still an argument that can be made between between the people that have been conditioned to buy the dips and those that think that we have just seen a major low for yields, a major top in prices. This was also an important week in that the Trump administration was meeting with Xi Jinping of China, and the meeting was completely overshadowed by what went on in Syria last night. Gold prices have popped on the upside and are now trading at a new recovery high. And provided that they can hold that move through the end of the day, well, then we will be able to say that that this is a higher high, and that there is growing evidence that this rebound is still intact for gold, and that the potential for it to get back up and test the upper side of that lengthier range is looking more likely than not. The most important thing that has happened in gold in the last 5 years has been that it rallied to break that really quite prolonged 5-year downtrend, and now we are in a period of right-hand extension, which is characterized by volatile ranging, and we have certainly had some of that. That also suggests that the potential is that we get if volatile ranging is the order of the day, then we are coming up off the lower side of that range, and there is a progression of higher reaction lows. The Gold Shares ETF is also in somewhat positive territory today, and is continuing to hold that $20 area. So it is looking increasingly likely that this too will be able to benefit. Now, if there is increasing demand for bonds, and there's increasing demand for gold, and the yen was reasonably steady here today, but did not rally through 110. I think that of those three safe havens, the yen has already been quite strong, and it is in an area of resistance. So I think a lot of people will be watching this 110 area to see if it can hold. But generally speaking, if safe haven assets are beginning to attract attention, we should probably look at what is likely for stock markets. And we have had an incredibly powerful advance since November. This has been really very, very impressive, that the surprises have certainly been on the upside, and Wall Street, having gone sideways for a couple of years, broke emphatically upwards. There isn't a great deal of evidence to say that it is over when one looks at the Nasdaq chart, but it is overextended, and we are coming towards the end of what has been a very impressive, but it's also the most seasonally favorable time of the year. What we can see on this chart is that there was a relatively inert range between 1400, excuse me, 4600 and 4900 between about August and December. And now we're getting a relatively inert, an even more inert range, which has really only got a 200-point amplitude. Now there is the potential that we just go sideways, and that is certainly what the S&P 500 has been doing. That is, I think, the best case scenario, that the markets simply go sideways, in a manner similar to what we saw between December and February, and what we saw between July and November. That is the best case scenario. I think the worst case scenario is that we get a somewhat larger pullback and we go sideways, or we go through a medium-term correction at some point between now and the end of the third quarter. We have certainly seen in the last year that there has been, not just the last year, in the last 5 or 6 years, that there have been hiccups along the way sometime in the summer. And there is I think there is ample potential for that to occur again this year. We know that there are certainly risks out there. I guess the imposition of the USA into the Syria situation, where there is already half a dozen competing sides warring, is an additional risk factor, not least because of the deteriorating relationship that that would represent with Russia. Russia simply cannot afford to lose its only Mediterranean port. They're the country with the single clearest objective in that conflict, and I think that suggests that, you know, that if we look at it in those terms, the chances are that they will do whatever it takes to ensure that they can hold on to that naval base. When we take a step back and we really look at what is going on out there in the wider world, there are certainly a lot of news items, and the news is dominated by Europe, and it's dominated by Brexit, and now it's dominated by Trump. I think it is interesting that the meeting with Xi Jinping was completely overshadowed. It's practically impossible to find any news items to tell us what exactly they talked about, or how successful it was, or did they make any div anything really to say about what the relationship between China and the US is going to be. What we can certainly say is that there is still this blindingly fast pace of technological innovation, and there are certainly arguments about whether it has been overhyped or not, but what we can quite, and I think we have to just go with the price action, that this week, for example, Tesla broke upwards, and that was in response to the fact that its valuation is now larger than Ford's. Ford sells millions of vehicles, and Tesla sells about 100,000 a year. But it isn't so much about the number of vehicles that it sells. It is about the different business model that the two companies employ. There is, and I thought that it was interesting that it was on Monday, the leading advancing share was Tesla, and the leading decliner was O'Reilly Automotive. And O'Reilly Automotive gives us a very different picture. This has been ranging, and with a downward bias for much of the last 12 months. But that followed what was an impressive 8-year advance, where the share went from a low of 20 to a high of almost 300. Now, that's an incredible advance. It's also consistent with the view that people didn't have money for new cars after the credit crisis, so they were doing up their old ones, and that increased demand for parts. But of course, electric vehicles don't have half the parts. They don't break down as often. And that represents really quite an existential threat to parts suppliers, that the size of their market is likely to shrink over time rather than grow over time, which is what it has done for decades. And This looks like a this looks like a type 3 top, and that would suggest that it isn't really just about electric cars. It isn't just about the different business model, but that that electric vehicles have a disruptive effect. And the fact that the Volkswagen emissions scandal has finally been revealed, and that there has been a response, means that emission standards are going to be enforced and may even get tighter. That car companies will no longer be able to rely on the clean diesel moniker as a way of boosting their environmental credentials. So they're going to have to invest in eco-friendly vehicles. So the march of the electric vehicle, despite the fact that they still have